COVID-19 hits Detroit. A longtime journalist and Detroit native tells us about this moment in her city.
When you start to see people that you know, sources that you've interviewed for years who are succumbing to this virus, that hits hard.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for April 7th, 2020. Also on the show, the very real consequences when President Trump promotes an unproven drug in the fight against COVID-19.
It is not altogether clear that hydroxychloroquine works for treating COVID.
And as more people lose their lives to the coronavirus, funeral directors adapt to more deaths and share their words for a nation in mourning.
I think rituals say what our words cannot. As a community, we'll be supporting each other and finding new ways to grieve. And it's really a grieving year that we're encountering.
All right, let's get going. It's hard to imagine that just 1 month ago, our world looked so different. At the beginning of March, roughly 70 cases of COVID-19 had been recorded in the U.S. Today, there are around 370,000 reported cases, with around 11,000 people dead. And as these numbers increase, we're getting a clearer picture of who is most vulnerable to this disease. In Michigan, one of the few states releasing data on the racial breakdown of cases, African Americans are getting sick and dying at a disproportionately higher rate than other communities. So today, we go to Detroit, where the situation continues to worsen by the day.
As of today, nearly 80% of the positive COVID-19 cases are in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties. Over 40% of our total population lives in the same area. When the question is about what's happening in Michigan or what's happening in Detroit, it's really about the region where we have the most populated density.
That's Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer on Monday. In the state, more than 17,000 cases of the novel coronavirus have been reported, with over 700 people reported dead. And Detroit, the state's largest city, is Michigan's hotspot for COVID-19.
Our hospitals continue to be overwhelmed, particularly in southeast Michigan.
It seems like for the last 2 weeks, we have been catching up and chasing strategies.
In recent decades, Detroit went into economic decline, with the city's working population facing the brunt of its economic collapse. In 2013, the city of Detroit filed for bankruptcy. But in more recent years, we've begun to see glimpses of hope for the rebirth of the Motor City. Still, as COVID-19 works its way across the city, it's unclear what the future holds for Detroit. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD at Slate. And I'm filling in for Tanzina Vega. And today on The Takeaway, coronavirus in Detroit. Helping us break all this down is Kat Stafford, a reporter covering race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. Kat, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you start by giving us the latest of kind of what we know about COVID-19 in Detroit?
So what we've seen kind of develop over the past couple of weeks is really concerning. Every day you log on to Facebook, it's like an endless stream of memorials. People are concerned. People are frankly dying. And this is really serious. And when you broaden it out and look at the state of Michigan itself, this seems to really be hitting the African-American community particularly hard. In the state, 33% of the cases are African-American, and 40% of the deaths so far are African-American. So it's leading a lot of people to ask, why? What is going on?
When you look at those numbers, the racial breakdown, and look at, say, access to healthcare and health resources, are those distributed equitably in Detroit?
That's a great question. And that is one of the reasons why so many reporters such as myself have really been pressing the state and other states, frankly, for this type of data, because it really starts to peel back the layers of inequity, right? So when you look at this community, you have to understand that Detroit historically has one of the nation's highest poverty rates. Detroit also has historically had a lot of water shutoffs. And when you have state officials and federal officials telling you one of the most simplest things you can do to combat this virus is to wash your hands, when you think about the fact that there were people in the city of Detroit that didn't have access to water, how can you do that? When you look at the fact that African-American communities are more likely to be exposed to heart disease or asthma rates because they live in these industrial cities, it's concerning, but you also have to look at the medical system itself. And a lot of experts that I've talked to, even doctors, have said and admitted that, yes, we know that there are medical bias in our system. We know that a history of systemic racism also factors into African-Americans not being able to access equitable care.
You mentioned people staying home and, you know, what we've seen, kind of limited services, particularly in light of the bankruptcy a few years ago. What kinds of resources do people have to enable them to stay at home? What are we talking about in terms of access to water, food, supplies? What do they got?
When you think about people that live in cities like Detroit, how can they stay at home when they're more likely to be in the service industry? They're more likely to be these folks that fall in the essential workers class. So they're still out and about. They're still traveling. And also in Detroit, you have a lot of the population that does not have a car. They don't have access to transportation. So they're still taking the buses. They're still out there walking around. And in Detroit, the other issue is there are a lot of food deserts. There are places in the city where you have to travel more than 2 miles to get some groceries, to get simple things like milk and bread for your family. So when you put all of that into the pot, it becomes that much harder for people in a city like this one to really try and stay home and social distance.
One of the things I've been struck by is how hard even local leaders have been hit in Detroit. Can you contrast what you're hearing from local and municipal officials with what you're hearing from, say, Governor Whitmer at the state level?
Yes. So in the city of Detroit, we've seen people from every facet of life be hit by this virus. We've seen the police chief James Craig of the city of Detroit was diagnosed with COVID-19. Thankfully, it sounds like he's doing much better. He's healing. City Council President Bridget Jones, we've seen a lot of officials have these diagnoses, and it's on every level. I mean, every day you wake up and it's a fear of, will my family member be the next person on Facebook or social media? So a lot of people are seeing that this is real, and a lot of people are taking it serious in the city of Detroit and other African-American communities across the country. So it's really just a scary situation some are saying to be living in right now, knowing that this city is a hotspot.
There was a sit-in over the weekend at Sinai Grace Hospital. Some workers were protesting the resources that they had available to them. I'm wondering what efforts to fight the COVID pandemic have looked like kind of at the community level, whether you're talking about protesting or mutual aid groups, things like that.
One medical official that I spoke to, she said it was like a tsunami, just in terms of the amount of patients coming in who are seriously ill. And it's a lot. That's a lot to bear for a lot of health workers to be on these shifts where they're just seeing a patient who could have been talking to them yesterday and conscious to the next day, they're gone. So when you think about the toll that this has taken on our health workers, when you think about the people that are outside volunteering, trying to deliver meals to the homeless in our community to make sure that they still are getting the resources that they have, this is really taking a toll on the city.
On an economic front, we've seen nearly 10 million people around the country file for unemployment. What does that look like in Detroit? And have people been able to access the kinds of benefits that are available to them?
So Governor Gretchen Whitmer Monday held a press conference just to update the state as a whole on where efforts stand. And one of the things that she really spoke about in extent was our unemployment system and how a lot of people, when they've been applying for these unemployment benefits, have faced long wait times or the system has crashed. So they've been working around the clock to fix this issue. But just like every other state across the country, it's just been, again, a tsunami of people really applying and trying to get these benefits. And people are asking, will the state be staffing up? She said, yes, they're increasing staff. And the governor even said she plans to help out herself to really process these claims. So a lot of people are trying to apply for these benefits. I mean, our small business community especially has been hit hard. When you look at Detroit historically has also had a very strong base of these mom and pop shops, these small businesses that are the strong backbone of the city, and they have been hit so hard. So the question becomes, when this is over, what help will be there for these small businesses? Because they're going to need help beyond right now.
When you think about the city facing coronavirus and the economic fallout of that, what does that do to the kind of nascent attempts the city has been making to try to come back from bankruptcy?
I think that's a major concern for the city of Detroit. When you look at the city and what it's been through, municipal bankruptcy, just the fits and starts to try and really rebound the city's economy, when this pandemic hit the city, is putting an unbelievable strain on the resources, because of course the city has to take this seriously, for which they are. They're devoting resources to this effort. The city just announced they know that they have a huge amount of people, like I said, that don't have access to vehicles. They're going to be picking people up and taking them to testing sites. Those types of things cost money. And what are you diverting those resources from to pay for these things? So we've seen a lot of officials talk about, okay, we're going to need to tighten our books. So, of course, there's a lot of concern on what total impact will this have on the city's economy.
There's been some tension in the past 10 years between Detroit and, say, state legislators in Lansing, figuring out what the city, quote unquote, deserves. Do you feel like the state is backing its biggest city right now?
I think the state, frankly, has no choice but to back the city, because Detroit, once again, is the largest city. And Detroit and Wayne County specifically, which is where the city is, they are being hit the hardest by this pandemic. And in order to turn the state around, in order to really battle this virus, you have to divert resources to these two locations. And that's what the state is doing. The state is working hand in hand with the city of Detroit. And like Governor Gretchen Whitmer said Monday during her press conference, she said this is an all-out effort by us on the state level, by us in the cities, in the counties. So what you're seeing are a lot of people coming together and working toward finding a solution to make sure that the residents in the state are safe.
I got to ask you, this is your hometown. You've been a journalist there for a while. How are you doing?
Thanks for asking me that. You know, the hardest part about this is when you're covering this type of story, it's hard. And usually as journalists, we're trained to handle these types of stories. But usually we have the outlet. We're able to go out. We're able to socialize with fellow journalists to kind of talk about these issues. And right now you can't. So that's hard. And it also is doubly as hard when you start to see people that you know, sources that you've interviewed for years, who are succumbing to this virus. That hits hard. So I've been telling all of my friends to make sure that we're all practicing self-care, the same self-care that we're writing and urging our readers to do. We need to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves as well.
Kat Stafford is a reporter covering race and ethnicity for the Associated Press, and she joined us from Detroit. Kat, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
There are more than 5,000 confirmed cases in the city so far, though the real number is likely much higher. One of the people who's been diagnosed with the virus is Brenda Jones. She's the current president of the Detroit City Council and a former member of Congress for the state of Michigan. She recently tested positive for the coronavirus, though she told me her symptoms are mild and she's currently in isolation at home.
I found out that I had COVID-19 sometime last week, during the week of last week, and I was sent an email to inform me that I tested positive.
How are you feeling right now?
I am blessed. I am strong. I feel good. But it's something that I know that I tell everyone, please take this serious. Although I feel good, everyone is not as blessed as I've been. And some have had more severe symptoms. So it's something that people must take serious.
As the city council president, what has this meant for how you do your job, you know, having to work remotely and do it from home?
I've been able to continue to do my job. I have held video conferencing city council meetings. I've had different panelists there from the health department, from our testing site, our resources on giving meals to people. So as a community leader, I am still doing my job.
And what do your constituents tell you at those meetings?
They're asking questions. I had a constituent that was extremely concerned about how I was feeling. I informed them that I was feeling well. Just at times, I'm extremely shortness of breath. So my constituents have truly been concerned, and I've received a lot of love and prayers.
For the most part, do you think people in Detroit are taking this seriously?
I think people are taking it seriously, but I also feel that because the weather has broken and, our younger generation is having difficult staying at home during the warm weather, so the mayor has had to take down basketball hoops and to encourage our residents to comply with the stay-at-home orders. I think most of our residents are taking it seriously. However, you still have some that I don't think is taking it as serious as others are.
You know, it's not just you. Obviously, the police chief also tested positive for COVID-19. And I guess I wonder if seeing people like you and the police chief come down with the virus might change the way how residents are looking at the threat around them.
Well, something that I can definitely say is it does not have a face. It can happen to a local elected official. It can happen to a federal elected official. It can happen to our police chief. It can happen to anyone. The coronavirus does not have a face on who gets it.
Last month, you said you'd be challenging Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib in the upcoming Democratic primary for the 13th Congressional District. Are you still doing that? And how is this affecting your ability to campaign?
It's not just affecting my campaign. It's affecting everyone's campaign. But what I am doing is videoing from my home. I am making telephone calls from my home, telling people that they must get out and vote. I am staying at home and staying safe and keeping others safe. And I am campaigning from my home and talking to people from my home.
I wonder if it's difficult in your position because on the one hand, you're clearly still doing your job. But do you ever want to say, you know what, I'm taking a sick day to show my constituents that this is serious. And if they get sick, they should take a sick day.
So when I don't feel good, I take time out. But when I'm feeling good, I let my constituents know I am your council president and I am here to continue to serve you and service you from my home. And just as my staff is working from home.
Detroit has had a pretty difficult decade. Do you worry about how fragile the economic recovery is and what this pandemic could do to Detroit?
As you know, we have casinos, and all of three of our casinos have closed. It has affected the businesses here. However, Detroit will continue to rise. Detroit has managed to work together to make Detroit continue to rise and to help Detroit continue to rise. We're going to have to change our budget, but we will continue to serve our citizens here in the city of Detroit.
Is there anything you want to tell your constituents or listeners across the country just to keep in mind as this epidemic goes on?
Make sure they are continuing to wash their hands. If they do not have hot water and soap, to please use hand sanitizer. I want to tell them to keep their hands out of their face. Do not put your hands in your eyes, in your nose, in your mouth. To practice social distancing. If you know that you have tested positive, quarantine yourself. Do not go around others. Continue. I cannot press enough to continue to practice social distancing. I want to tell my constituents in the city of Detroit that I appreciate them But I also want them to take this serious. Michiganders, we are strong. Like winter, spring, summer, and fall. This too shall pass.
Brenda Jones, president of the Detroit City Council, former member of Congress, thank you for joining us, and I hope you feel better very soon.
And thank you for allowing me to talk to you and all of the citizens who are listening around the United States.
Over the past few days, President Trump has once again been promoting the use of the drug hydroxychloroquine as an effective treatment for the coronavirus. That's a drug traditionally used to treat malaria and autoimmune diseases like lupus. Trump announced on Sunday that the government had bought 29 million doses of the drug, even though there is unclear evidence of its efficacy in helping coronavirus patients.
If it does work, it would be a shame if we didn't do it early. But we have some very good science. I've seen things that I sort of like, so what do I know? I'm not a doctor.
But a lot of doctors are riled up by the president's promotion of hydroxychloroquine as an untested treatment for coronavirus. According to reporting from Axios, it's led to infighting at the White House's coronavirus task force between economic advisor Peter Navarro and infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci, who has called the evidence of the drug's efficacy merely anecdotal. Peter Didon is the Singapore professor of infectious disease at MIT, and he joins me now to talk about hydroxychloroquine. Peter, thanks for coming on.
Hello, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Can you explain what exactly hydroxychloroquine is? I'm sure a lot of people are hearing that name for the first time over the past few weeks.
So hydroxychloroquine's a very old drug. It was developed in 1955. It's been used to treat two major diseases. One is malaria. But besides that, it's also used to treat autoimmune diseases, and it's even more widely used for that, things like lupus and certain kinds of rheumatoid arthritis. This is a frontline drug for those diseases.
I should note, actually, that I have an autoimmune disease, Sjogren's syndrome, and that I've been on hydroxychloroquine myself for several years. I'm not on it now because I'm pregnant. But this is something that really is knit into the daily life of someone with a rheumatic disease. How important is continuing that therapy if you have lupus, RA, something like that?
Oh, it is the frontline drug for lupus. And discontinuing it, all your symptoms and problems are going to worsen. This is a chronic therapy. This isn't just a short term like an antibiotic kind of thing. People that take it need it permanently, unless they have something else to fall back on, another drug.
We have heard President Trump say, what do you have to lose by using it to treat coronavirus? But I'd like to get your take on that, because there is something to lose here.
Well, there is. By proposing to use it for COVID, there's going to be millions of people who will want prescriptions. If that robs the people who really need it of having the drug available, they're going to suffer. The second problem with this is that it is not altogether clear that hydroxychloroquine works for treating COVID. There's some anecdotal evidence. We do need clinical trials, true clinical trials that really show the efficacy. The reports I've seen have not shown impressive efficacy in treating the disease. If someone were in a desperate situation and they're on death's door, then why not try this drug? I agree with that strategy based on the anecdotal evidence that's out there. But for someone who's just got a fever right now and is showing some symptoms, there are terrible side effects in using this drug. And it's not worth the risk of trying it on someone who doesn't have established COVID disease or who isn't very, very severe with COVID.
Peter, what would constitute enough evidence to show in a well-controlled clinical trial that hydroxychloroquine works for COVID?
Well, the way these trials are set up, you have to get hundreds to thousands of patients. You can't tell them what they're taking. They either get placebo or some other treatment, or they get the hydroxychloroquine. They don't know. You don't want placebo effects taking place. So you need these hundreds to thousands of patients. You test to see if you do get statistically significant therapeutic effect And that's the question right now, is that we're not seeing really statistically significant therapeutic effects taking place. It's a small effect. If it's a large effect and it happens in hundreds to thousands of patients, then you're done. And if it's safe and efficacious, that's what the FDA demands of all drugs.
And the studies from France and anecdotal evidence in China do not meet that bar, in your opinion?
Those have only had tens of patients, and the margin of efficacy is not all that impressive. It's pretty small relative to the placebo effect in the patients that didn't get it.
On Sunday, the FDA made an emergency use authorization for experimental use of the drug from the national stockpile. How rare is that for the FDA to say, okay, go ahead?
It is pretty rare. And it is only in the most dire of circumstances that you would do that. This is indeed a dire circumstance. You've got a disease that has no therapy whatsoever. So you're going to try whatever shows any promise. That's good for preparing a clinical trial to do it, but that's not good for actually starting to distribute the drug to people who ask for it or for doctors who prescribe it. That can run into a danger. This is not a non-toxic drug. And in fact, one of the toxicities I didn't mention before was that it's an immunosuppressive drug. That's how
right.
It works against autoimmune disease.
Yeah, it suppresses your immune system. The president said that the FDA gave it, quote, rapid approval. But is that accurate?
Not in the sense of saying that this was now approved from clinical trials to be efficacious and safe. They gave it an emergency approval for use only by physicians in the most dire of circumstances.
There is anecdotal evidence, and indeed I have heard this from the doctor who manages my own autoimmune disease, of hoarding, of kind of just-in-case prescribing. How have you and your colleagues reacted to that?
Well, honestly, I don't know firsthand of seeing people hoarding the drug. I've heard this in the news reports, in the media. I believe it. I would imagine that it's just like toilet paper and Clorox wipes and everything else. If the drug shows any promise, the general public's going to want to have some. This is wrong. This is simply wrong. What's going to happen if the manufacturers can't keep production up to meet the demands of people hoarding it, then the people who truly need it, the autoimmune sufferers, malaria victims worldwide, won't have the drug available for them, and people will die.
We have heard a lot of information from the president, but elsewhere too, about drugs and treatments that are purportedly for the coronavirus. What is the best way that people can ensure that they aren't being duped, that they're using something that may have some clinical efficacy?
There is nothing. There is nothing out there that has clinical efficacy at this point. You know, washing your hands, keeping distant, don't touch your face. All those kinds of silly hygiene issues are the best way to prevent it. Since there is no cure, you've got to prevent it. Anything on the internet about a drug, I just received a comment by email about artemisinin. There's no evidence whatsoever that this is going to work. So people are flailing around trying to find or irrationally promote some snake oil. There is no treatment yet, and we have to wait to see the truly proven, safe, and efficacious drugs that might work against COVID-19. And they may come.
Peter Didon is the Singapore Professor of Infectious Disease at MIT. Peter, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Having me.
Almost every single part of our lives has been disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic. Schools have been closed, weddings postponed, and public spaces are nearly empty. But something else that's changing in a major way is how we mourn those we've lost. Around the country, the funeral industry is struggling to keep up with the growing number of deaths from COVID-19. Funeral directors are being forced to adapt their practices and traditions in this age of social distancing. For some, that means going completely virtual, holding memorials on Zoom or Facebook Live. For others, it means limiting the number of funeral attendees to just immediate family. And what's happening now is likely to shift how we grieve in the future, too. For more on this, we turn to two funeral directors on the front lines, in Southfield, Michigan, and New York City, respectively. Stephen Kemp is director of Kemp Funeral Home and Cremation Services and a spokesman for the National Funeral Directors Association. Amy Cunningham is a funeral director and owner of Fitting Tribute Funeral Services. Amy, Stephen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Lizzie.
Also with us is Gary Latterman, a professor of American religious history at Emory University and author of the forthcoming book, Don't Think About Death, A Memoir on Mortality. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
Stephen, I want to start with you. You've been working as a funeral director for a long time in Southfield, Michigan. How has the work you do shifted over the past few weeks?
Well, I feel more now, especially in the last, week and a half, I feel more like I'm a triage physician in an ER that's really being pressed because of the sheer numbers that are occurring in our community right now. My zip code where my funeral home is located is the largest outbreak outside the city of Detroit, which I'm connected to the city of Detroit, but I'm just outside of that. And so we're experiencing now in this last 10 days, a week of exponential growth of deaths.
Have you stopped doing in-person funerals altogether?
No, we have not. Presently, according to Governor Whitmer, we can do up to 50 people 6 feet apart. And so we've been doing that. I have a pretty large chapel here, so we've been doing that. And people are having their services, and we're simulcasting the funeral to people who cannot make it.
How do you balance the kind of direction you get from, say, Governor Whitmer with your obligations to a family and sort of figure out a happy medium there?
That's our duty as professionals. We have, we serve our families as best we can, and these are challenging times. So you take what the rules are and the social distancing, and you have to explain to the family how important it is that we do this because of the large communicability of this virus, that we have to be 6 feet apart. You cannot have, and we will be policing that, you cannot have more than 50 people at the service. If not, we'll have to shut it down. You know, the reception has been pretty good to it. I mean, it's almost like a shock to begin with because the death oftentimes has become so insidious and quick that families really don't have time to grasp actually what happened to them. You know, I just finished with one this morning where she's actually an ER nurse, and it was her mother. She had just talked to him 5 minutes before. Another person had talked to him 5 minutes before. She called him again. She wasn't answering the phone. She could see her through the window, and she died right in her chair. And, you know, the daughter is just beside herself. So,
Amy, I imagine you are probably wrestling with some similar things. You're in New York City, where I am, another hotspot. Are you taking similar steps as Stephen?
Yes, I think we're even ahead of Detroit in that we are recommending families only have the simplest kind of graveside service gatherings so we can manage burials and have 6 to 8 people around the grave standing a safe distance apart. Our cremations currently are mostly direct cremations with a memorial service planned by Zoom afterwards.
Wow. Do you have to walk families through kind of what they can and can't do? And how do they handle that?
One thing that has been surprising is that deaths in the home, sometimes out of hospice care, so deaths from COVID-19 in the home, in those cases, the family calls 911, the medical examiner arrives, and currently they're not wishing to claim all those cases. So I've been speaking to 3 or 4 families a day with a deceased person in the house, guiding them through the new reality of the fact that they have a home funeral on their hands. And I try to get them to light a candle and make the space sacred and bring flowers in from the yard until they wait for the funeral homes that are so overwhelmed it sometimes takes some hours to arrive.
Gary, I want to zoom out a little bit. Can you talk a bit about the state of the funeral industry before this pandemic hit and the kind of capacity that was in the system for the number of deaths we're seeing now, like we're hearing Stephen and Amy describe?
We're under extraordinarily unusual circumstances. So I think everyone is just trying to think on their feet and not get too overwhelmed, even though all these bodies are overwhelming. There's a lot one could say about trends in the funeral industry before all this hit, but one that I find somewhat interesting, and I think, you know, obviously by necessity accelerating, is, you know, funerals without a body, and sort of raising the question of how important is it to have a body present during a funeral. And I think more and more people in the 21st century is more comfortable without the body present. You know, and then now we're seeing, again, you know, kind of forced decisions and other kinds of pressures that are really shaping a whole new terrain for thinking about how we dispose of our dead.
Well, let's go into that a little bit. Stephen, I would imagine that this pandemic has affected the methods used to care for bodies of the deceased and perhaps maybe some traditional burial customs that are parts of different faiths.
In terms of handling people, I haven't changed my methods. We always use universal precautions. Tell people whether it's a 90-year-old lady from a nursing home or a medical examiner case, we treat everyone like they're infectious or have a communicable disease. And that way you don't slip you can't depend on a death certificate or notification oftentimes, because maybe what I'm beginning to notice here is we don't have a diagnosis, confirmed COVID diagnosis by the time that they pass. And sometimes that may come afterwards, and it's too late for us to even know, you know, their diagnosis, pneumonia or flu. And we find out some days later that they were COVID positive. So we treat everybody like they're infectious.
Amy, do you worry at all about the space available to hold bodies in places like New York City? You know, thinking of morgues and cemeteries and some of the kind of frightening stories we've seen over the last few days.
The city has been scrambling to provide portable morgues for the hospitals, and now they're helping funeral professionals get the equipment they need, and conversations are ongoing about where to put all the deceased bodies. One thing I was teaching and thinking prior to all this is that I've been helping folks understand that a funeral is not just an hour-long event or a single viewing. We need to expand our awareness of what a funeral can be. And it's really a grieving year that we're encountering. And these families can see opportunities in that time allowed that expand beyond the service they feel they've lost.
Stephen, you mentioned the precautions you're taking, and I'm thinking about these two funerals in Albany, Georgia, that have been linked to the spread of COVID-19 there. You know, the idea was that the funerals were these sort of super spreading events. And I guess I wonder how you talk to people about taking, you know, these very sort of rigorous mental precautions at a time when really they are governed by their emotions or want a hug or, you know, need that human connection. Is it hard for people to get that dual message?
Yeah, I think it is. It's very difficult. You know, I'm fortunate enough to know most of the clients that I serve, and I know their families, have known them for many years. And the key to tell them is at the arrangement conference, whether it be at their house or here, or virtual online, we're doing a lot of them online, is I have to tell them what the rules are. And I hand them out what Governor Whitmer's order says and that we plan on following it. And oftentimes they hem and haw and say, well, can we wait? And I said, you sure can, to plan at a later date to have a memorial. But oftentimes a lot of them say, well, we really want to get it done. And, you know, let's just have this service with 50 or 10. Or they do immediate cremation and have them decide to have memorial service at a later point.
Gary, I'm thinking a lot about the Civil War these days. There's a remarkable book called This Republic of Suffering, written by the former president of Harvard, Drew Gilpin Faust, where she talks about the intimacy that people gathered with death during the Civil War. And it was a real tectonic shift for the way Americans thought about death. And I guess I wonder, is it overblown to think about this as perhaps analogous in the way that this epidemic is touching so many people?
Civil War definitely is an interesting kind of touchstone historically. But you can also think of other episodes of what I and others would refer to as mass death. You know, massive amounts of death, public awareness and consciousness of death to large numbers of people. Obviously, this happens during times of war, but also during, you know, epidemics. You know, that's a whole other level to this. In addition to the sort of individual existential realities of the kinds of deaths that you're hearing my colleagues talk about on the radio show, there's also the collective impact of the total sort of overwhelming number of dead that will have surely a long-lasting repercussions in our collective consciousness, in how we think about America and how we think about some of the larger social transformations that are likely ahead.
Amy, I wonder about that sort of individual grief compounded with mass societal grief. What does that mean, do you think, for the people you're serving and how they process maybe the death of a loved one in the middle of a pandemic gripping their city?
There will be community in these numbers and new rituals that may emerge out of all this creative energy. I think rituals say what our words cannot. So as a community, we'll be supporting each other and finding new ways to grieve. I found that online Zoom services are surprisingly moving, that somehow out of this adversity, wisdom is springing and we're discovering new things about technology that we hadn't anticipated.
And people don't seem to hunger for the kind of physical contact that often comes with ritual?
I know they do, but how else can we manage, you know? Through our eyes, through our voices, we're lighting candles and using music and just trying to enter in to this grief rather than resisting it. I do tell folks that closure is a mirage. Some folks say, oh, I wish I could have the closure that a funeral might bring. Well, I think this weight of the grief we will carry for the rest of our lives, this is historic. And to use that grief to comfort others, to be a stronger person going forward, to let your love for the person you've lost move you into new directions is perhaps the potential of this tragic time.
Gary, what do you think the biggest way this pandemic will transform the way we mourn is?
The loss of intimacy and thinking, you know, how do we do right by our dead in these circumstances is going to require new kinds of ritual innovation, all kinds of new ways to create meaning and to really mark what every society, you know, marks, which is this rite of passage.
Stephen, I'm going to give you the last word. For someone listening to this who may have just lost a family member or a friend to COVID-19, what advice would you give them?
What I would advise is that take a deep breath. This is a new kind of reality that we're dealing with right now, but we're here to take care of whatever needs they want. And we typically can be very flexible, but the rules, you know, we have to look at a general public health in whole. And, you know, what I tell people is that, you know, we are the end care healthcare workers. And if we're not there, nothing can really happen. And, you know, let us handle some of your grief and let us be the professionals we can and try to handle, do what you want us to do with the constraints and the paradigms that are left us. And that's what a funeral professional is for. I tell people, I don't deal with the dead. I deal with the living every day. It's important that people follow through with their rituals and as much as they can in this new kind of reality.
Stephen Kemp is director of Kemp Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Southfield, Michigan. Amy Cunningham is a funeral director and owner of Fitting Tribute Funeral Services in New York City. And Gary Latterman is a professor of American Religious History at Emory University. Thank you all so much for joining me.
Absolutely, my honor and pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, that's it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. It's been great being here with you. And remember, I want to hear from you. You can call us on any topic at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet the show. We're at The Takeaway on Twitter. If you want to follow me, I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly. Yeah, Lizzie O'H-Reilly. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.